Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Nucleus Investment Insights. The topic and question for today is Omicron and the potential investment market impacts. We're going to look at the background of the virus, then we'll explore the key unknowns. Next, we'll look at government and people's reactions to date. And finally, we'll explore some different Omicron scenarios and how they'll likely impact investment markets. My name's Sam Kerr, and I'm the Senior Advisor at Nucleus Wealth, and I'll be the host of the show for today. We've got a bit of a full house today. Damien Klassen. Damien, welcome. How are you going today?
Not bad. Hi, Sam.
Excellent. And we've also got David Llewellyn-Smith, the Chief Strategist at Nucleus Wealth. Dave, how are you going?
Good. Good to be here. Thank you, Sam.
Excellent. And we've also got Radek Zelini. He's the senior analyst and a core part of the investment team at Nucleus Wealth. Previous to being in finance, he had a career as a scientist with a Bachelor of Science majoring in biochemistry. So he's going to give us some interesting insights into Omicron today. How are you going, Radek?
Yeah, good.
You well? That's great. So just a quick reminder before we get started, if you enjoy our content, please subscribe to the YouTube channel and click the bell to be notified when we go live, or you also know when we have a new episode recorded that you can watch. Alternatively, follow us on your preferred podcast platform. Our show is available on all the majors. For anyone listening in live, feel free to drop some questions into the YouTube live stream chat and we'll do our best to answer them during the show. Now that we've got that little bit of housekeeping out of the way, we'll get into things. So, Damien, I'll hand it over to you.
Yeah, sure. I just wanted to highlight as well, I guess, to everyone that, you know, we're not really trying to, we're not sort of trying to come up with some views and on the virus itself in this. We'll talk about what we know so far. The key bit is, yeah, there's so many unknowns at this point, but I guess what we really wanted to sort of pitch was the different angles and what you can do in terms of how we should be looking at reacting and what are the key factors we should be looking for as we're going forward, because there's so much information out there at the moment. If you want a the end of the world is nigh view, you can absolutely find it on YouTube. But if you want a everything's fine, let's get on with it, you can absolutely find a plenty of people telling you that as well. And so what we really want to do is sort of hone in on what some of the key things we're watching and what that's going to mean in terms of what you should be doing in terms of investments from there. So, I guess we brought Radek along to sort of give us a bit of a background, given that he sort of spends a lot of time looking at healthcare stocks and reading stuff from the Pfizer's and Moderna's and things like that. So I might hand over quickly to Radek to give us a little bit of what do we know about it so far, and then we'll sort of jump into the key part, which is really how do we react to that and what should we be doing.
Okay, well, Omicron, what do we know? First thing, I guess, it emerged in South Africa in November this year, and it's probably looking at that little picture on the left, it's about the fifth major variant that has emerged. And the interesting thing about COVID is, unlike measles, it is actually a virus that is mutating. So it's more actually in the mold of influenza. So every year, I guess, influenza mutates, and we're seeing something similar with COVID. I've read one report where actually it seems to have a mutation rate of about half of influenza. So that is good news, so it won't be mutating as fast. But this one has obviously emerged. And the important thing now is to look at the two factors with viruses, which is its transmissibility and its virulence. So transmissibility is how it sort of spreads across society, and virulence is how deadly it is, I guess. At the moment, it looks to be very infectious. So estimates are it's about 1.3 times as transmissible as Delta. And that sort of seems to suggest that previous exposures give less protection. And I think Damien will go more into that with the numbers on South Africa. The other thing that's...
I think as well, Reddick, that's interesting, Reddick, as well. Like in terms of, in talking about the, it only mutates half as much as what influenza does. Mm-hmm. But it's also interesting that you've got that graph on the right, on the left there, sort of showing that this strain actually came out of the original strain, whereas Delta sort of pretty much took over most of the world. You sort of, at a base level, you'd expect that the strain, that the next mutation would have come from the Delta, but I find it quite interesting that it's sort of actually come from a fair way up the path.
Yeah, I think it's almost random. Obviously, mutations are random, and where they occur and out of which strain they emerge is very difficult to predict.
Mm. But I guess at face value, though, you'd think that because Delta's the dominant strain globally now, you'd expect that that's where most of the chances of the mutations are going to come from. So
the next one may very well come from that one. So. Mm.
Yep. Yeah, sorry.
No, and so, yeah, so transmission and virulence. Well, transmission, you can see there on the graph, it looks to, versus Delta, it's a steeper curve. And we've seen with that global map that it's already, the cat's out of the bag. The number of countries that now have it is... extensive and probably very difficult to contain.
And so that graph as well, that's the one from South Africa, isn't it?
Yes.
The region in South Africa that's most affected by it.
Yes, I mean that's the early data. I also should say that everything we're talking about is very preliminary and should also be taken with a grain of salt because it needs verification. That's what the world is currently waiting for, is for the data to come in so they can...
Yeah, that's right. And that's where...
South Africa actually has pretty good data, though, doesn't it? Does it not? Like I read somewhere that it had reasonable infrastructure in place from, the AIDS epidemics and stuff. So it's hospital systems reasonably well set up to process the data.
And I guess they have past experience with epidemics. So.
Yeah.
But just to show you how this is evolving, just this morning, Pfizer, came out with claims that it's three doses of its vaccine produces much protection as against Omicron as the two doses against the original variant. So every day, it's you sort of virtually have to. See what's new in this area.
Yeah, and that's sort of what we wanted to hit in this podcast is which are the areas we really want to be watching and which are the ones that we're sort of saying it's noise but not not as important for investments.
All right, well, I might pass on to Damien to talk about what is happening in South Africa.
Yeah, sure. So one thing I just wanted to highlight, so this is more just, I guess, virus background as well, before we sort of jump into what are the key parts we should be watching, is one of the things really is this idea about this infection rate. And so when you've got new strains coming in terms of the infections, is there's two places they can generally get their three places in a way they can generally get their new cases from. One is from getting the people who haven't had the disease and aren't vaccinated. The second one is from people who have who've already had the disease, and then the final one is from the vaccinated people. And so if you look at South Africa, the vaccination rates are very low, so that part. Yeah, there's a big pool of unvaccinated people that can obviously draw from. The thing with South Africa, though, is if you dig into the data a little bit, and that's the graph we've got on the left here, sort of showing the official rates of deaths from COVID, and then the reported excess deaths that have occurred in South Africa over that time frame. That, depending upon how you want to interpret that data, there's some people who can, and it's a probably reasonable assumption to make that a lot of those excess deaths probably are COVID related. And so if you made that, it's quite possible that COVID sort of maybe two or three times, they've had two or three times as many cases as what's been reported. And then if you extrapolate a little bit further and then say, okay, South Africa's got quite a young population generally, and when you look at the death rates, you can very easily come up with the figures that actually probably most of the people in South Africa have probably already had the disease. Already caught the virus. And so the issues for that, and sorry, Reddit, can you just mute? For people who've already had the virus, and so what that's sort of saying is that if you is that this is really it's reinfecting people who've already had it, and the benefits you had from already having the virus and the immunity that gave you has really dropped away, and so the reinfections is a big issue. So in a way, then that actually makes some of the data about some of the hospital data possibly seem even better, because if you've got a large portion of the people who have already had the disease, and you know, the fear was that when people have already had it and they've got a weakened immune systems, and then they get hit again by another variant, that's enough to kill them. Is the fact we haven't quite seen that yet. Not to say we won't see it, but the fact, you know, the early days look pretty promising, is quite possibly a positive sign.
So that would be analogous with the double wave of the Spanish flu, wouldn't it?
Yeah. In terms of your first wave weakens your immune system, and then the second one sort of hits you and wipes you out. And so the fact that this one hasn't, it's most likely, well, if it's only hitting people who haven't had the disease already, I think. The numbers are basically suggesting it's the most. If that was the case, it would be the most virulent disease basically ever that we've seen. It seems a lot more likely that it is actually infecting people who have already had it. So that's one part. I've got another chart up just sort of showing the how contagious, you know, you can see from the data. And again, you know, all the disclaimers about really preliminary. This is just a study out overnight. It hasn't been peer reviewed. You know, there's all these potential issues with it. But you know, the numbers that are coming out is basically showing that, you know, right down the bottom, you can see the bottom of the chart on the left is that Omicron is just miles above any of the other ones in terms of the in terms of how fast it's growing relative to these ones we've seen before in the past. And then, given that that's the case, you know, just wanted to highlight, you know, over on the right there, we've got the cases in Denmark, which is a pretty that's a country which pays a lot of attention and reports really quickly the data back on new strains, and you can just see there it's just taken off in the last few days alone, which is you know, highly suggestive that, look, this thing's out there, you know, that gene is not going back in the bottle. It's now a matter of trying to work out what, you know, where it's going to go. Okay, so that's sort of the background about it. Oh, sorry, and the other thing, so Reddick spoke a little bit about that, the Pfizer study that came out that was talking about, it's about three times, they're saying that three doses of the vaccine actually give you the same immunity that two doses gave you to the prior one. It's worth noting that there's been a few of these different studies out there.
Are we talking about transmissibility or hospitalization?
They're still talking about.
I don't think it's trans. It's not transmissibility. I think it's hospitalization is the. That's the key statistic that everyone's looking at.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that they know the transmissibility with the vaccines.
Mm. The best you can have in terms of immunity at the moment is you've been double vaxxed, or sorry, the best we were looking at was saying you're double vaxxed and you had the disease, sort of gives you this level of levels that is well above everything else, and then you come back to, okay, now you've had two doses of the vaccine, and then a little bit lower as you've had the disease, and so and I guess the suggestions are that third one is now taking you up to the stage where vaccinations do look like they'll be a lot more effective in terms of keeping it out. So
I might just jump in here and just say I've seen reports saying that if you've been previously infected, it's only about 50% effective versus Omicron. So it's usually the antibodies that are that you get with natural protection, but with the vaccine, it targets more areas. So you probably get more protection with a vaccine than you would have with a natural protection. So that's what it seems to be showing at the moment.
Yeah, and the other one I would say is that it's very scattered. Like the studies seem to be showing, like they've got the here's your median, but they actually seem to be really wide. And maybe that's an element of if you'd actually caught something that was on the sort of the Delta stream, which was a completely different version, maybe you're less protected than if you'd caught it on one of the earlier streams and picked up similar antibodies. But yeah, that type of stuff we really don't know. But let's come back to what does this really mean for what are the key things we really need to be watching over the days ahead, and what is that actually going to mean for your portfolio, and how are we going to treat this, and how politicians are going to treat it. So the couple of key unknowns versus the big one for me is the effect on infants. So I've got a chart up here which is just showing that this is the first 2 weeks of data from the third wave of coronavirus in this key city where we're seeing an outbreak in South Africa. And the blue lines is the age distribution of the third wave, and then the orange is the age distribution of this current wave. And so you can see that it's clearly very much younger and affecting in particular the one of concern is that 0 to 4 range on the far left. Is saying, okay, if it is going to affect infants in particular who are unvaccinated, obviously, but if it's going to affect them a lot more, then that's going to have, much larger, that could have some much larger impacts in terms of how governments react and certainly how anyone who's a parent of kids of that age is going to react to this. So it's still very unclear that, we're not talking about big numbers here. A lot of these as well, when you look through the more detailed data, a lot of these are still quite mild cases, and a lot of them were actually picked up because they were in hospital for something else, and they were tested for coronavirus, and then this came up. So it's not necessarily a really bad sign, but it's certainly one that we need to be well aware of, trying to track over the over the coming weeks. The next part, the severity. I've got a graph up here showing on the right is the South African data for hospitalization. Unfortunately, I couldn't get that on the same basis from the same data provider. But you can see that that's sort of taken this really big jump up in recent times, and it's certainly running quite hot in terms of the number of people that are being admitted to hospital in South Africa. The thing is, though, on the other chart, and noting that the other chart's on a log scale, South Africa is sort of similar in size to places like France, UK, Italy, and they've actually got way more people in hospital than what you're seeing in South Africa. So obviously the trajectory is the issue in South Africa. Is this bouncing out and it's going to come roaring out and it's going to blow it all away? But it's worth noting that a lot of these other countries already have way more people already in hospital. Over this, and so we're not comparing. The trajectory in South Africa is important, but also understanding that South Africa is starting from a much better position, and so maybe the trajectory, if it flattens out once it gets a little bit higher, might bring everything a little bit more back into focus. So yeah, so and the third one. So the first one is the. Just sort of reiterating. First one is the effect on young people. Second one is this idea about hospitalizations and how fast that's going to happen. And again, too early to really tell. And then the final one is this mortality. And this is a graph also showing about the hospitalization, but it's also sort of showing this idea that the number of people, certainly in this wave, being admitted to hospital is a lot lower than what we've seen under the prior wave. And so... again, it might still be an issue in that if it infects way more people far more fastly, which far more quickly, which it seems like it probably will, this could turn in the absolute number of people could turn into an issue, but for the moment that seems to be seems to be under control, or sorry, it seems to be not of concern. There is that potential danger, though, as well, is that, and one to keep watching, is that people have it for 2 or 3 weeks and it's very mild or doesn't affect very much, and then all of a sudden it gets much worse, you know, by the 3rd or 4th or 5th week, which is clearly entirely possible at the moment, and we're just not going to know for some time. But yeah, they're the three key things we want to watch. And then so that's hopefully that first part out of the way. Now we really want to get into what does that actually mean, and what are the reactions, and sort of spitball some of the scenarios. So that's where I guess we'll sort of bring Dave through to the in this. We've got, you know, so how are governments going to react, and populations as well? So I might start with travel bans, Dave.
We obviously saw a very strong panic when the strain first emerged a week or two ago. That was followed by immediate travel bans to South Africa. That haven't really mushroomed very far as yet. However, we are already seeing some advancing rollbacks of freedoms in some areas, most notably overnight in the UK, where they didn't go back to lockdowns or anything, but they went back to work from home, wearing masks, these kind of social distancing measures, which I think we can more or less expect everywhere. Yes, Damien?
So, can we just jump on the travel bans first? So I just want to go through that, as, I guess, just through the effects of that, because to me there's sort of two elements to the travel bans. One is, will governments put them on or not, and how that's going to affect the population, and then the second part is how do people react to these travel bans, and are we at the stage where I think for me, you know, we've seen over the last, certainly for somebody sitting in Victoria who's been used to travel bans and not being able to go anywhere for a long time, we've seen this opening up, and I think globally it's a case as well where governments were starting to say the UK government coming out and saying, you know what, we're open for business now, you know, you can start booking your holidays, you can start doing things and getting back to your normal life. And then all of a sudden there's these issues with travel bans, and like, well, if I travel to another country and that country has an outbreak of a new mutation, will I be allowed back? Because that certainly, if you're a UK citizen who'd traveled to South Africa, and then all of a sudden you can't get home because of these bans, you know, whether there's a psychological impact, that's actually happened, and it's going to really affect, I guess, travel in particular as a thing.
Yep, absolutely. I do think that advancing travel bans, official ones, are plausible. At this stage, you know, governments are having just reopened, will be loath to do it, but if we get in a month or so and we're seeing these huge spikes in transmission, even if it's a milder version of the virus, as you say, if the absolute numbers really start to hammer hospitals, then some form of containment measure is a logical consequence for policy. We'd have to debate what they will be. But travel bans may be a part of that, maybe not. Hey. Sorry, guys. Work from home. So I wouldn't write off travel bans, but, I mean, hopefully they won't be coming surging back. Potentially the personal impact is... Poppy, can you... Thank you. Crazy little girls. So potentially the personal impact, I think, is pretty big. As Damo, you say, not just the fear of the virus itself, but definitely the fear of disrupted plans, getting marooned somewhere, etc., even though, you know, perhaps travel bans aren't quite as likely as the Delta wave, it's still enough. Looks like it will be enough to upset plans on that front. So, I mean, I can't rule them out, I guess is what it comes down to. At this stage, you know...
Well, and possibly the damage is already done, though, in terms of...
Yes, yes, possibly.
Because you do wonder if, say, Singapore had isolated this, or the US or UK or something, whether you would have seen the travel bans come back on. And it's sort of almost the fact that it's like, oh, this is a developing country that's sequenced it, and so therefore... Yeah, let's throw some travel bans on because it probably won't hurt that much.
Excuse me, guys.
Whereas there's probably a I'll let you sort that out. Whereas there's probably a So my thoughts behind that is that within the travel bans there probably is a much larger psychological impact in terms of the investment side than and just the effect on people within that. So. So I think as well with all these because of what the government reaction is one of the most important things we need to face is that if governments are going to feel the need that they actually have to be seen to be doing something, that maybe these travel bans are something they feel as if, well, I can put those on, the effects aren't going to be that much, but I can feel as if when I'm talking to my population, I can feel as if I've done some good. And I think that's where the next stage I wanted to talk about in terms of lockdowns was why do lockdowns at all? And so the first part is, well, you do lockdowns because you want to get your contract tracing up and you want to get your systems ready and things like that. And that's not an issue for Omicron because the contact tracing, as we saw through the Denmark ones, this is so contagious. We lost track of contact tracing through Delta. There's almost no way that contact tracing is going to sort Omicron. And then the other reason, you do it because you want to sort out contract tracing. You do it because you want to get your systems ready. The problem with getting your systems ready is, well, if you're 2 years in, and you haven't got your systems ready, then having a lockdown isn't going to help you at this point. So that sort of that argument for having a lockdown is gone. An elimination strategy is another one. You would think that's gone as well. Potentially in China, they'll keep that. But that idea around locking down in order to eliminate the virus, that's not an option in this case. The third one, slowing down to sort of relieve the load of hospitalizations. Now this is the most likely reason why you'd see lockdowns in terms of this. So I think there's a case to be made potentially for that. But again, as we saw from the data so far, the hospitalizations haven't been that much of an issue. Potentially, it will become a bigger issue, but really, for the moment, that doesn't seem to be the case. And that sort of leaves you with the last reason for lockdowns is really just this idea of fear and governments feeling the need. They need to be seen to be doing something. So if if your hospitals aren't overrun, you've got no chance of an elimination strategy. Your system should be ready by now, and if they're not, locking down isn't going to help. So really, it's coming down to will there be enough government feel to need to be seen to be doing something that they want to start the lockdowns. And I guess that's where I'll throw back to you, Dave, what your thoughts are on which governments feel the need to be seen to be doing something.
Well, I mean, a lot of this is very complex stuff, isn't it, in terms of reaction functions in different governments and cultures. But I suppose if we probably should use the Delta analogy as some kind of model to give us a sense of how individual countries will react. So I would expect the US to react the least, given it's the most driven by individualism and sort of personal responsibility. So I would expect, therefore, lockdowns to be pretty on the nose there. I mean, not least because it's got a very strong kind of libertarian impulse as well that permeates its politics. At the other end of the scale, you've got China, which is still zero COVID, and I can't see why it would change anything at this point, given Omicron, could be immensely infectious there. It will be more difficult for it to contain, so there's a possible economic implication, but I don't think they'd give that up. Their own batches of vaccines are pretty ordinary in terms of efficacy as well, so they're not very well positioned for it. I would expect zero COVID to persist there, and even more intervention, I guess, is likely in China because of the transmissibility effect. Australia's kind of caught between the two. You know, the southeastern states, it's pretty much cat out of the bag. Possibly Victoria, you know, is going to be more interventionist than New South Wales, but, you know, they'd be probably splitting hairs as the two premiers have pretty much agreed on an approach so far.
And it seemed, though, as well, if you've basically said, I can't control Delta, it's pretty hard to then
make an argument
to say you can.
Exactly, control, and Australia's very well vaccinated at this point, very high, much higher than the US and Europe. But at the same time, you know, South Australia, West Australia have already locked their borders down, and I would expect them to continue. Mm. Queensland.
Well, and having said that, though, when you're saying about the vaccinations, it's true that we're much better vaccinated than a lot of countries. But the problem is almost all our vaccinations have come in the last 6 months.
Yeah.
And so we can't actually get boosters generally for the average population, person in the population. You know, boosters are meant to be a 6 month thing. And actually, maybe Radic's got any thoughts on that. I'm pretty sure it's a 6 month.
Can you go earlier, Radic?
Is it going to make a difference?
Can go earlier.
Does it risk?
The other reason for maybe pushing it out, though, is that messenger RNA vaccines, which are the Pfizer and Moderna ones, are very easy to retweak towards the new virus.
Yeah.
So it might even be in your interest to wait 1 or 2 months before they develop a new variant of the vaccine to fight the new variant. If you know what I mean. So,
if you were to accelerate that, was there a possibility of accelerated side effects to upset the populace?
Well, they've shown that the general infrastructure works and is safe, and all they're really tweaking is a small bit of code which they're putting in. So it's a question of how the FDA in America and the TGA here allows it to go through, how quickly. So I think they would. I think that, you know, they're fast tracking it, so I suspect they would do that again.
Yeah. So, and I guess, you know, there's Europe on top of that, which again is more of a hybrid approach, certainly more oriented to kind of social welfare outcomes. And as I said already, we've seen some new measures in the UK. I think that's likely to spread, given Europe has already caught in a new Delta wave. I think it's going to be seeing Omicron sweep through in such a way that probably requires policy intervention. It may be that we just see more social distancing rather than active lockdown, but we will be seeing some stuff, and then you'll get the private sector reactions on top of those. Are we any better at living with the virus these days? Yes, but I mean, are we good at it? Probably not. Australia least of all, I would say, given how sort of pampered we've been with our zero COVID strategy for years.
And just over the extra, you know, impositions in terms of saying, well, especially if it's seen to be a less deadly variant, it's like, well, I still did this stuff when Delta was out there, and I had a 1% chance of dying, and now I've got a half percent chance.
Absolutely. If it turns out to be half as virulent, which those early numbers suggest, then all of this is going to go away. I mean, that, you know, the one thesis we haven't mentioned here is the possible outcome where its virulence is sufficiently lower that it's actually, you know, good for the pandemic. You know, spreads like wildfire and gives a lot of immunity, and at the same time doesn't cause that much illness. And in which case, then the private response would probably be pretty good, and might even counter any kind of government overreaction if there is any.
Yeah.
I mean, Jim Bianco put up a pretty hysterical post or tweet with some very good data in it in the last few days, using Australia as the analogy for why you should fear further lockdowns from governments worldwide, because they'll freak out. Kind of along the lines of Damo's thesis of looking, appearing to do something. But for our international listeners, I can say he overdid it a bit on the Australian analogy, and it hasn't been as draconian as he's made out. So, therefore, if you're concerned about imminent and hard panics from governments based on, you know, things like an Australian example, then I would probably discount that. But yeah, it's definitely a movable feast, and we need to follow, as Damo says, those three key indicators of how the virus evolves, because obviously that's going to determine these things.
Yeah, because I mean, we start getting babies in hospital and babies on ventilators and dying,
like,
then
you're into moral panic territory, and
exactly,
you definitely have to see governments doing something at that point.
Yeah, and so you'll see parents of young kids and grandparents of young grandchildren and all that type of stuff. Put a whole bunch of measures in to restrict their own, even if governments don't come in and do the restrictions. You'll see, a pretty decent proportion of the population, wind back what they're doing economically and socially and things like that. So, it's really a question then of going, I should take one more thing I actually wanted to discuss before we get into, what are the stocks and what are the sectors that you're looking at, is this idea of the boosters. So we spoke a little bit about vaccination and boosters and Australia being in a good position for the double, but actually not for the triple. The other issue is the government approach to largely vaccinated versus largely unvaccinated populations. So if you're, say, a leader in the US, and this shows, and potentially this kills a lot of people who are unvaccinated, but if you are double vaccinated or triple vaccinated, then it's actually a very, very low risk, let's call it a one very low risk, as opposed to two varies, but which looks like it's probably one of the base cases at the moment. If that's the case, then in a country like Australia, you're probably more likely to say, okay, we're largely vaccinated. We'll do a few little things, but will we do large-scale lockdowns for people who have chosen not to be vaccinated? The answer is probably no. If you're in the US, where you've got a much larger unvaccinated population, does that pressure then start to rise? And this case, David, with it does affect infants more, but it gets shown to be that largely vaccinated populations are fine. Do we see a different reaction where the US might actually start overdoing the lockdowns? You spoke about them doing the least amount. Could we end up in a position where it's actually the opposite? They do the most.
I don't think so. Not in the US. But I mean, I think the one thing that we can probably say with some certainty is, we're going to see more social unrest around this, because you need an entire new generation of vaccination. The fact that it's come around so swiftly with a new strain and is starting to look flu-like as an annual event, is going to add to, general exhaustion in response, I think. So you're likely to see more anti-vax movements and people, and then you're caught in policy terms about whether to install, persist, or expand kind of vaccine apartheid, but whether to separate your populations. And that's very socially divisive. But of course, that still rests upon the profile of the virus. If it turns out that it's harmless enough, then none of this is going to happen. It has to be harmful enough for it to threaten lives. But yeah, I can see it exacerbating existing tensions, social tensions that we've seen develop, which will have policy implications. Maybe a little bit economic as well. Probably not that much though, in terms of macro implication.
Mm. But it does seem as well at the moment, you know, as feeding this through, is that it's again, you know, we're in the hands of governments for so many things at the moment. But really, it's a government reaction to this. You know, we have a path of a virus where, you know, it's twice as
not entirely though, because I mean, if everyone just threw their hands up and said, okay, let's move on and forget about it, and then you get your hospitals get swamped. People start to die, then, you know, government's forced into action.
Yeah, I guess what I'm getting to, though, is, in the more severe cases, you're right, governments need to be forced, but let's say it's twice as contagious, but half as deadly, and so you actually end up in roughly the same position as we are today, you know, the same position as Delta, because just more people get it, but it's not as deadly. Now, under that scenario, there's a reasonable case for, say, let's just continue with what we're doing and keep going.
Absolutely.
But if governments turned around and start locking down and doing other and adding more travel bans and all these types of things, then you can end up with a very different economic outcome than if the governments have said, okay, let's keep going with the same strategy. So
look, I don't think that I disagree with Jim Bianco, I think, in terms of betting on government panic. I think, you know, in Australia, for instance, where we've had a lot of lockdowns, and it's probably even more the case overseas, where they've had enough and are perhaps less, shall we say, nanny state oriented than Australians, that nobody really wants to do lockdowns again, you know, like, and it's not going to be favouring the popularity of a government that does it, you know. I think unless you're already in like a zero COVID circumstance, such as WA or South Australia, then the calculus is different, because you're obviously inviting illness into a zero illness context, and that comes with a political, cost. But I don't think the governments are so irrational that they're just going to fly off the handle. If that scenario you describe, which is not a bad profile relative to the data that we're seeing, like that's roughly what it appears to be at this point, you know, with all the caveats of it being preliminary, then you should just proceed. And I think governments would, in which case it will just be reopening. I mean, you probably want to be shaving a few points off, you know, your growth outlooks, because I think you'd see stuff on travel and whatever just because of the uncertainty factor. But I really don't think that it would have macro implications if that's what Omicron is. Then I think we'd be basically pushing ahead with the post-Delta reopening.
Hmm. Yeah.
And that's probably the base case at this point.
Yeah. So so going back to our scenarios from last week, I've updated them slightly. So we spoke before. We spoke last week about saying, okay, Omicron harmless, sort of. You know, there's a few different things that'll come out of that, and maybe David, I might let you talk to these ones in terms of the.
Sure. Well, I mean, last week we had. Have you changed these probabilities?
I did. Sorry.
So we had Omicron harmless as a 40% probability. I'd probably actually cut that one down a bit more than 40 now. But anyway, that's fine. It's sort of 30 or 40%. That in that scenario, you know, it's the good mutation, if you like, where it becomes much more transmissible, but also much less virulent. And so all you're really doing is immunizing a whole lot of people without that much illness, and that would be terrific. In fact, that could present the end of the pandemic. Scenario two, which is the one that's really firming as the base case, is that it's disruptive in some way. But I would argue even at this point we're at the harmless end of this scenario. As we noted last week when we put these scenarios, scenario two is the broadest one on a sort of continuum, where you could see some very different policy outcomes and economic outcomes in scenario two, where Omicron's disruptive, depending on how virulent it is or how transmissible, etc. I would say at this point, the macro implications are probably not enough to include a Fed slowdown to tightening, for instance. You know, markets last night, they've been all over the place, basically. Markets for the last week or two, one day you get, essentially pricing action that indicates Omicron's harmless, the next day disruptive, the next day harmful. Last night we had one in which it was disruptive enough to slow the Fed. We had a really kind of big reflation push on all the stuff you would expect if the Fed was going to slow, you know, the US dollar falling, commodities rising, these kind of things. I don't, at this point, I wouldn't agree with that. I think we're at the easier end of scenario two at this stage, in which the Fed would just proceed with its accelerated timetable for taper and then hikes. So at this point, at the stage, therefore, I wouldn't be looking for the Australian dollar to be going sideways and up for very long. It's been bouncing in the last week or so after being flogged early in this process. But if the Fed is going to stick to its timetable of tightening, then I wouldn't expect that to last terribly long. And of course, our shrinking scenario three is a harmful Omicron, you know, which was both more transmissible and more virulent. In which case, you know, that's really another market shock. Probably not as bad as March 2020, but certainly something that was material. But that case does seem to be fading, thankfully, with again, the caveat that the data is early and, you know, some of the province in South Africa is starting to see rising ICU cases. So hopefully that doesn't come. But certainly I think there's enough data out there for us to have lowered that probability. So at this stage, you know, things could be worse, basically, in terms of Omicron. There are some red flags that could develop into very, very large flashing red warning signs and air raid sirens, etc. But at this stage, we appear to be tracking towards scenario two and maybe the better end of it.
And possibly, I'd be saying somewhere between good end of scenario two and the bad end of scenario one, sort of our.
Yeah, at this stage,
yeah.
So, you know, I mean, markets have been celebrating that, but if we do go that way, then you know, we're suddenly confronted with policy normalization and the tightening Fed and the wind down of fiscal stimulus, etc., around the world. And, of course, the lingering inflation problems from this year. And so, you know, we're back to the sort of key rubric. It's a bit redundant. The rubric that we've operated under for the last 2 years, basically, which is, as Damo said earlier in this potty, we're in the hands of governments in a way that none of us really want to be. So policy and policy error become, you know, very central to investment outcomes. And so even with a good Omicron outcome, there are some reefs and rocks ahead for your investment ship to navigate.
Yeah, and so some of those, obviously the travel, you know, I think probably takes a bit of a its outlook is worse now than what it was, say, 2 weeks ago.
I think that's fair. Yeah, I mean, travel's the obvious one.
Yep, energy stocks. That's probably, you know, we've seen a bit of an energy. Oh, the energy. Rise,
yeah. I mean, energy priced a lot of harm the moment it came out, so that's probably done enough. And we've got, you know, we've still got, unfortunately, all of this geopolitics going on around energy in Europe, which is really elevating a lot of prices and gas, and and some other fixed energy inputs. So, yeah, I mean, I think energy is probably priced the shock that we're going to have.
But as it is, the gas prices are still quite high, and oil prices are still relatively high, which is a headwind for the economy, I suppose.
I mean, they're high relative to where they were late in the last cycle, but they're not that high compared to before that.
They're high enough. But energy prices are.
Energy prices are. Gas, in particular, is outrageously high still, as Putin and Europe slog it out. Equities, we're still quite underweight. Based on basically a mid-cycle slowdown thesis as all of the extraordinary stimulus comes out. And now, with lingering inflation issues, we still think are temporary but lingering. The Fed is almost forced into a late-cycle posture where it's got to tighten very quickly just to snuff out some areas of inflation. So we feel like equities are a bit at risk. We're already seeing, obviously, bond yields rising at the short end with the Fed, but we're seeing, a pretty dramatically flattening yield curve. Even on some of the OIS markets, we've even seen inverted curves in the last week or two. And so that's telling you that the market thinks policy error is a real risk here for the Fed. Those are the issues that keep us cautious on our equity weighting. We're tilted towards quality, defensive, and quality growth. Give us a kind of barbell on the two possible outcomes from the Fed. And we're picking up, kind of long bonds as they sell off. Because we agree with the market, basically, that the inflation is temporary, and that if the Fed pushes this very far at all, then we'll be seeing rebounding deflation before very long, and growth starting to struggle the deeper we get into 2022, especially as China continues to go through its structural adjustment. Europe fades with it, and the US continues to lead, giving us a strong dollar, and that makes it tough for global liquidity.
So, Sam, any questions?
Yes, we've got one from Ryan. It's sort of linked into one of the previous podcasts we did, one of the recent ones. So his question is, does China's COVID-19 policy increase the risk of more supply chain shocks?
In short, yes. I guess that's the short answer. And Omicron probably increases that a little as well. But I don't see that as a material risk. If we take, what we think is the base case at this point, the sort of harmless end of disruptive, then we should be able to just march on through those. The transmissibility is an issue for a zero COVID policy in China. I mean, it will certainly increase the number of shutdowns they'll have to do, and that will tip into some supply chain stuff. But at the same time, part of the whole mid-cycle slowdown thesis is that we see goods demand come off a little anyway around the world, and some of that service spending come up. But at the same time, yes, there's a little bit of pressure for that to not proceed at the same pace, given Omicron may just retard services rebound a little and support good spending in the short term, and just until we kind of get greater clarity on it.
And the other one I'd note, Dave, is one of the key things driving a lot of particularly the logistics side is that I can't remember what the percentage was, 40-50% ballpark of air travel, of air logistics, used to go in the bottom of passenger planes. So you were sending something from whatever, one country to another one, and it didn't necessarily go on a dedicated jet quite often it would just get stowed in with the normal baggage. And the issue there is that most of that, so even though we've had a lot of air traffic sort of pick up again and start traveling, one of the key problems is the air traffic between China and other places really hasn't. And say China and the US, let's use that as one of the key routes. And so this sort of to me says, okay, that's going to be sustained for longer. And so, while I think most of the supply chain shocks are probably out of the way, I do think there is that potential if China's going to keep going with this zero policy, they're going to have to shut things down. But also, I think the path to normalization gets extended a little bit further. So things might be, under these moderate scenarios, if China doesn't have to do extensive lockdowns, it'll still get better, the supply chains, but it won't get better as fast as if we hadn't have had the Omicron out there, because we'll just be limited. The amount of travel is going to be limited relative to where it was sort of otherwise.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, excellent. So I think there's a few other questions, Sam.
Yeah, so we've got one other question here. Could a greater negative impact from Omicron lead China to be less inclined to allow their building sector reform/fail? And what would the impact on commodities be?
Yes, but I don't think we're tracking in that direction. At this stage, I don't think Omicron is tracking as serious enough to do that. But yes, definitely, if it was, they would. I think just throw it all out and, flood stimulate again. And in that event, well, I think we all know the result. Commodities to the moon.
Mm.
But I would say that is a risk case, not a strong risk case.
Yeah. And I think we've spoken in the past about this, about saying they seem relatively committed to, and they should be relatively committed to bringing down the amount of overbuilding in the economy. But that's the lever they know works if things get bad. Yep. So the question really for them is saying, how bad will things need to get before they do that anyway? So, and our take is, well, we'll at least go to where we went to in 2015 slowdown and potentially further before they finally start to stimulate again. But this is a worse outcome from Omicron is certainly going to be it's certainly going to help accelerate that timetable. So I would think though, under that scenario, you'd probably get commodity prices would fall first before rising, I guess, is if you're going through that yes, it's quite disruptive and there's this negative effect, you'll probably have to see that effect come into play before governments actually react, I think. So I think there's that part about when, at current rates, it's almost as if, well, if the copper price is still high, then things must be all right, so therefore we don't need to stimulate as much. Whereas when you start going, okay, copper price is crashing, aluminium prices are crashing, all these other factors, okay, now there's more impetus for the Chinese government to get involved.
Awesome. I hope that answers all the questions. That's everything we've got for just now in the chat. We had some really good discussion last week in the comment section regarding the question of, has the Aussie dollar bottomed? So the question for this week, for the viewers this week, is which Omicron scenario do you think is most likely? Do you think it's harmless, disruptive, or harmful? So, that's for the viewers to put into the comment section, have some discussion over the coming week. So that almost wraps us up. Have we got any last final thoughts there, Damien or guys?
I'm good, thanks. Good.
Thanks, Sam.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thanks, Damien, David, and Radek. Great insights as always.
Thanks, Sam.
For the next variant.
It'll be coming. So we do welcome your feedback on the show, especially in regards to suggestions for future topics. If you do have any ideas, please drop it in the YouTube comments below or send us an email at contact@nucleuswealth.com. Just a reminder, this is general advice and doesn't take into account your personal situation. If you do want to discuss how you can take advantage of these global trends and themes, go to our website and you can book in a call with our team to have a discussion about it. So just want to thank the guys and thanks to everyone who's watched this episode live and everyone watching the replay. Don't forget to like the video now. And finally, if you know of anyone that might get some value out of this podcast, please share it with them. You can see some of our previous content if you head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. And to stay up to date with us on news, you can follow us on social media. Thanks again for tuning in. For myself, Damien, David, Radek, and the rest of the team at Nucleus Wealth, we look forward to seeing you at the next episode. And bye for now.